Welcome to episode 51 of Booty and Bossy Eat, Drink, Knit. We are still celebrating.
Yep.
Not just 50, but 51. So we're celebrating with a cake, which not only is a really good recipe, but also has a great story that goes with it. So, Bossy, do you want to tell us about the cake?
I frequently encourage my students to reach their academic potential by incentivizing with a cake. And so I had a student, his name is Jevin. This has now become Jevin's Victory Cake, who took a class over the summer. And I said if he did well enough, I would bake him a cake. And then he achieved the goal. And so I said, what kind of cake do you want to make, or do you want me to make? And he said, well, I really like Oreos. And so I thought, okay, maybe I'll just buy him a box of Oreos. No. He said, but what happened to making me a cake? So I actually researched online and found this great recipe for an Oreo cake from the website Sugar Spun Run. The woman who did it, I instantly liked her. She said, "Hi, I'm Sam. I'm dedicated to bringing you sweet, simple, and from scratch dessert recipes. My life may or may not be controlled by my sweet tooth. Send help or chocolate." So already I like this woman. This is a great recipe, but I want to warn you, it takes an entire family size box of Oreos. And when I brought the box of Oreos home, immediately my husband was like, "Ooh, Oreos." And I was like, "No, do not touch the Oreos." And this cake recipe, you will only have two Oreos left.
Oh, gut wrenching. Well, and my daughter had the same reaction. Oh, Oreos. And then it was like, no, those are for a recipe. Yeah, I actually did not use all of them. And here's why. You're going to use your Oreos in two places. You're going to use them in the cake. And that, I think it only took
It's 20.
20. So that was maybe half of the package. And then for the frosting, you're going to pulverize Oreos and mix them into the frosting. I was not a fan of this idea because it's a cream cheese frosting. And when you add the pulverized Oreos, it's essentially,
It kind of comes out a little gray almost.
well, when you add
Yeah.
it to the cream cheese, so the pulverized Oreos are just black crumbles, and then you add it to the white frosting and it turns gray. And I thought, well, I don't think that's very pretty. So what I did was I did the cream cheese frosting and then I put sprinkles of Oreos on top, pulverized Oreos. If you do that, you don't need that much. You don't
Yeah.
need many Oreo dustings. So I have plenty left. I might even make like a crust for a cheesecake.
That's good. It's never a bad thing to have a family-sized box of Oreos in the house, I think. The possibilities are endless, and I am deeply grateful to Jevin for giving me the opportunity to discover this recipe because I've actually made it twice. I made it first for him, and I'm going to put a picture because he's just smiling from ear to ear. And part of the reason I used the whole box of Oreos was because I put whole ones on top, and then that did a very good job of keeping the aluminum foil from sticking to the cake. So there's architectural advantages.
Well, right. And that's a good point too. Real quick, but one thing that's important about the recipe is that you're using egg whites, and the reason you're doing egg whites and not egg yolks is that you're trying to keep the cake whiter, so there's more of a contrast between the Oreo pieces that are in the cake and the cake batter. So there's that. That actually, I thought, also gave it a really nice light texture because you whip the egg white. So this is definitely not your one bowl.
Not your one bowl, not this is a special recipe. for celebrating achievement. And I will just say, I don't know that Jevon's ever going to listen to this, but I was so proud of him because I remember having this conversation one time where I said, you know, I just feel you're very nonchalant in your approach to your academic work. And he said, I can't believe you're saying that to me. I'm the most chalant person I know.
You go, Jevon. You are chalant.
So this is a cake to celebrate being chalant,
Yes.
whatever that means.
You definitely check out the picture. It's so cute. But yes, and there are some special ingredients. Obviously, the Oreos for us, we don't usually have those on hand,
No.
unfortunately. Then there's sour cream. One thing she called for clear vanilla, and that's another it, trying to make it lighter. We just used
Didn't
regular
bother with that.
vanilla. Don't worry about that. And then the cream cheese frosting, obviously, you need cream cheese and butter and then powdered sugar. So all of that was great. I made mine into cupcakes because I thought it's just easier to distribute and it makes more portions. So I cut down a little bit on the frosting. She had you using 1.5 packages of cream cheese and 1.5 sticks of butter. So I just did 1 stick of butter, 1 stick of cream cheese. That was just barely enough to get 24 cupcakes frosted, but it worked. And then I dusted it with the crumbled up Oreos and the pièce de résistance. Is the mini Oreo that you put on top of each cupcake? I feel like that's very important. That's a must in this situation.
Well, and we should say we usually go through the ingredients. We're just gonna put a link onto it. I think the key things that Booty already mentioned using the egg whites. So it's two bowls. The other thing is a little bit different, and I haven't tried it the other way. It didn't seem like a big deal, but it's called reverse creaming, where instead of, you know, in a normal cake recipe, you would cream the butter with the sugar and then add the eggs. In this one, you're actually putting all the dry ingredients in, and then you're adding a tablespoon of butter at a time. For total of 6 tablespoons. And it's almost like you're trying to get the butter, you know, into fine grains and completely coated, almost like you would a pie crust. So that was kind of an interesting technique. I hadn't tried it before, but it did with the egg whites, it made a nice light cake. And then you do want the Oreos to be in. Like I just put them in a bag and used a rolling pin. You want them in kind of pretty big chunks. And once they're in the cake, they soften up nicely. And then you just have these nice chunks of Oreos in the white cake. So this was definitely great. What was mom's feedback?
Okay, so mom liked it. Everybody in her retirement home really liked it. The woman at the front desk said, "Tell your daughter she needs to open a bakery." So that was very nice. It's a really fun cake. I mean, and actually my daughter said, "Oh, cookies and cream is one of my favorite desserts," which I didn't really even know that.
Well, and it was very gratifying to give this to Jevon because he had this big smile on his face. And he asked me very specifically, he wanted to know how I made it. And then finally I said, oh, you know, are you interested in baking? And he said, no, nobody's ever made a cake for me before. So I want to know how you did it. And that just made me feel like that was worth the extra effort. But
Yes.
Booty, tell us a little bit about the history of Oreos because you got kind of curious about that.
So originally, the original cookie in typical fashion was Hydrox, which was a rather unfortunate name, I gotta say. Like, what were they thinking? But
I do remember those. I don't know if you can still get them, but I do remember.
the story of Oreo began in the early 20th century. So it was invented by the National Biscuit Company, also known as Nabisco.
Yeah, I didn't know that Nabisco was the shortened form for the National Biscuit Company. Did you
I
know that? I didn't know
no,
that.
no, I love that. It was founded in 1898, and their claim to fame was the animal crackers, the Barnum's animal crackers, which were, I didn't know this either. They were sold in little boxes with a string to like a handle, and that was supposed to be hung on your Christmas tree, which I thought that was cute. I did really like the little box, like the idea of it
I
was
remember
funny.
the boxes. Yeah. I
Yeah,
think you
like,
could still get them. Yeah.
yeah, and I think the marketing of that was very, very smart. So Hydrox was launched in 1908, and then Nabisco made theirs basically better. And
They
they,
had a food scientist who
right.
perfected the cream center.
Yes, and the cream center is very important. Now, of
Yeah.
course, at that time it was made with lard, and they've since changed it to vegetable shortening, which, well, probably not all that healthy, does make it vegetarian. And they started in 1912. So they've been around. And then we have all these different flavors. So there's chocolate, there's white chocolate, birthday cake, strawberry. Yeah. So, and of course, in October, the Halloween ones with the orange filling. I don't think that they're actually flavored. I think it's just orange color.
Color, yeah.
But anyway, so.
Nabisco was really great, not only with the taste, but also with the marketing. And now of course you've got the double stuff and you've got the seasonal and all that, but they have become some of the most popular cookies and most internationally recognized. If you want to buy into the Oreo juju, then make an Oreo cake for somebody special that you want them to know that they're special.
Yeah, and if, apparently it was originally sold in Hoboken, New Jersey.
Yep. So check out the Oreo cake recipe on Sugar Spun Rum. And thank you and a shout out to Jevin for forcing me out of my comfort zone and finding a new recipe and sharing it with all sorts of people who really enjoyed it.
Yes. Thank you,
Yeah.
Jeff. All right. So now we are back to No Idle Hands, The Social History of American Knitting by Anne McDonald. And we are on a chapter 13, which is the 30s knitting craze.
Yeah, and craze is really the right word because knitting literally takes off in the 1930s. We could say in the history of knitting that the 1930s are the Renaissance period of knitting because the National Dry Goods Association estimates that 1 in 12 people take up knitting during the 30s. They're 10 million strong. Just to put it in a broader context, it's the Depression. So birth rates and marriage rates and divorce rates are all dropping, but knitting
On the rise.
on the rise.
I love the there was woman who said, the radio was free. So you didn't have money, but you had time and you had the radio, hopefully. So this was a way that you could spend your time, and it was also kind of a therapy, which I think is appealing to a lot of us today with all the stresses in the world, that's why we're taking up the needles.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. I mean, knitting does have a long connection to being a therapeutic thing, but I was kind of surprised at how clearly it was articulated even then in the 1930s. There was a woman that worked as a receptionist in a psychiatrist's office and said, because the craft was recommended therapy for recovery from nervous breakdowns. So even then, and we heard about it earlier with soldiers returning from the war and having shell shock, that some of the veterans learned to knit as part of the therapy. But one economist wrote, quote, "Let the needles click. It helps recovery." So I thought that was an interesting kind of conflation of the economics of it, because there was a way that people had, as you said, time, but they didn't have any money. So this was thrift, But one New York Times writer also explained, in a period of worry and uncertainty, not only do we need relief from tension and a new channel for pent-up energy, but we need to see concrete results from our efforts. Needlework has filled the need for women ever since Penelope sat at her web.
I love that.
It's a loom, but she's not a spider, but
Yeah, I wondered about that.
it was amazing to hear how everybody's talking about it. Another New York Times article called The Knitting Craze and Enthusiasm Unequaled Since Wartime. Everybody talked and wrote about it, but few could explain it. One paper likened it to other fads. The click click of the knitting needles is again heard in the land, which proves, like the present renaissance of the bicycle, that there is nothing new under the sun.
Right.
And Priscilla Page from the Gentlewoman magazine says, these are knitting days. Everywhere we go, we see women knitting, old ladies, middle-aged mothers, young brides, 16-year-olds. Women are divided into two classes these days, those who sew and those who knit. There are no idlers nowadays who sit and do nothing.
Yes. And I think that's fabulous. I had to laugh at the, there were a few knitting bathing suit disasters. And so
You're gonna knit everything. You ought to knit a bikini. Well, they didn't knit bikinis, but yeah.
did. Yeah. Well, and by the way, I did one time knit a bikini for our niece, but in my defense, she was 4 years old. It was from the Stitch and Bitch. It had little hearts.
Oh my God.
So anyway. I used elastic, and that is the problem because when these poor women did not have elastic, so when they went in the water, the suit would just expanded and fell off, basically. And so one woman said, I squeezed out as much as I could and crawled crabwise out on the beach to dry. You can imagine the hilarity that greeted my emergence. We know someone who, in the 50s, she dove into the swimming pool and her falsies that were in her bathing suit top floated to the top. Very
I love that they called them falsies. You know, yeah, I thought the bathing suit incident was so funny because she said, it was 49 years ago and I remember it vividly still.
Exactly.
Those moments of public knitting embarrassment, we will not be able to get beyond those. I
Yes.
thought it was interesting. One of the things that they brought up was the idea of knitting, shutting men out. And I don't know if you want to read the Ogden Nash.
Oh yes. Yeah. So our mom, hi mom, is a big fan of Ogden Nash, and apparently he wrote a poem about knitting. Life will teach you many things, chief of which is that every man who talks to himself isn't necessarily out of wit his wits. He may have a wife who knits. Probably only he and his maker know how many evenings he has spent trying to raise a conversation while his beloved created sweaters by the acre. Ah, my inquiring offspring, you must learn that life can be very bitter, but never quite so much so as when trying to pry a word out of a knitter. I tend not to choose projects that are gonna make me not able to have a conversation when my family's around. So that's why you need
Well,
to have multiple projects.
yeah, I can see that. I mean, I haven't had, I don't think, projects that have required that level of concentration, but I thought it was interesting too that this woman commented that she used to be a knitter and then she kind of burned out on it and eventually came to sympathize with men. I mean, I just didn't know that there were that many men, women knitter haters out there. And she said she came to sympathize with men who hated knitting. And she kind of painted this scene of giving up her knitting and, quote, "Then I settled back to enjoy the quiet of my idle hands or the relaxation of fixing my gaze on nothing more substantial than the gauzy unfolding of my cigarette smoke."
See, replacing your knitting.
With smoking cigarettes. That's great. So while she's sitting there, and I just have this image of this woman pondering this as she's watching the smoke, but I found myself a keen and ever developing sympathy for the dislike some men have for women knitting. When a man watches a woman knitting, he feels shut out. She is absorbed by an occupation he cannot share. She is in a sanctuary where he cannot follow. And her knitting folds her in solidarity with other women. The whole character of a group changes when, after dinner, women fetch their bags, pregnant with colored wools, like squaws bringing out their papooses. That's a really odd comparison, but
Yeah, I didn't really get the whole squaw and papoose thing,
I
but
like the knitting bags pregnant with colored wools. I thought that
yes.
was kind of a nice, but. So I decided to do some research and I asked my husband if he agreed that knitting shut men out. And do you want to know what he said?
Yeah, what did he say?
He said, "I think knitting allows women to tolerate men."
Oh, good answer.
I thought that was a very good answer. He might just get a piece of Oreo cake for that.
I know, or a sweater.
Or a sweater, yeah. But
That's a very good answer. I did not ask my husband, although I certainly, I was very supportive. He buys me yarn and obviously supports my habit of knitting, so I assume that he is fine with it.
it was interesting because I think of knitting as a kind of social thing, that it's something you can do and you can talk or you can
Right.
watch a movie. So, this idea of these women being like, "Don't bother me, I'm knitting. Shut up, knitting. Stifle yourself."
Right, because I find it's a nice way to spend the evening if you're watching a movie or what, and you're producing something. You're not idle. No idle
Right.
hands.
No idle hands.
And
Yes.
you're not, I mean, the problem with sewing is sewing machines are noisy, so.
Well, this was my problem too with weaving, was that when you're weaving, you have to be at the loom. It's also pretty noisy. And yeah, it's hard to have, I mean, the most you could do is probably listen to music or listen to a audiobook or something like that. But even then, it can be pretty noisy, especially
Right.
if you're trying to do it fast. So,
Well, and speaking of your husband, I'd give a shout out to your husband.
Yes, he was the one who gave us the Anne McDonald No Idle Hands. He did a little research and found that this was the most referenced book on the sort of social history of knitting. And he gave it to me for Christmas. And then I, being a book bully, made Booty read it. But it's really provided us with a lot of episodes and just a fascinating history. I mean, it's really a wonderful book. So I am very grateful to him. He was also the one that suggested, why don't you do a knitting and pop culture moment for each episode? And he's been very good too about keeping an eye out for pop culture moments with knitting too. So I didn't properly thank him in episode 50. So I wanted to make sure and give him a shout out. He's also listening right now, so I don't know if you can hear him coughing and snorting too. He says he's drowning in the butter that's being spooned over here. I think the other thing that I loved about the 1930s is it's a return of boobs and curves. You know, remember the flappers? That really was a flash in the pan fashion moment where, you know, we remember how we have the flappers wanting the very shapeless, and the dieting so that they've
Right.
got the sort of boyish figure. Well, thankfully, the depression brings in a kind of return to boobs and pointy, perky boobs.
I never understood the pointy boob thing, but
Think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with Nurse Ratched and
yeah.
the torpedo boobs. I like that that returns. I love that everybody's knitting, 10 million people. And the other thing that comes back, well, this was great. She quotes one woman writing, "A gaily becoming sweater blouse always makes us feel like conquering the world."
The power suits. Well, and also the yarn companies were very clever in realizing that if you are making a sweater, that's 6 to 7 skeins of yarn. If you're making a suit, then it's like 28 skeins of yarn or something. I mean, and so this is also the invention of the circular needle,
Yes.
because, or I don't think it was when it was invented, but it was used more because to knit a skirt, you could knit in the round, and so in a much easier, faster way.
Well, and you also have, and I didn't even know there were needles this small, but you have the fad of sort of boucle knitting, which can hide a multitude of sins, but you're doing it on tiny, I mean, 4 zeros needle.
Right.
I
Right.
can't even imagine.
You also had the jiffy knits, which were bulky knits with big yarn or big needles. And they're popular from the sense that you could knit something quickly, but they didn't look so great.
Well, and didn't the Jiffy knit start in the 30s because there was a way, and yarn companies were so smart about promoting all of these. I mean, everybody's kind of talking about it, but they're promoting contests. This is also an opportunity for women to be employed as instructors and as writers. They're also working in retail at yarn stores. It's
Right.
also the rise of movies, and suddenly you have all of these knitting books with fashions modeled by the stars, like Joan Crawford and Hepburn are knitters, and they're on these movie sets, and in between, there's some great pictures of them sitting there and doing their knitting like their livelihoods depended on it.
Right, and there's even a book, the motion picture movie classic Hand Knit Fashion. And
So great.
I think that was in 1936. Those were patterns not necessarily knit by the movie stars, but there were plenty of movie stars who knit. And there are some fabulous pictures. We'll put them up on the website. Katharine Hepburn, like you said, and Joan Crawford. Yeah, so it's great.
And I mean, how great is that? That you see these movie stars on the screen, and then you can knit the sweater that they are wearing.
Right.
I think that's just great. But and they have some pretty serious prizes, like round trip, all expense paid trips to Hollywood. Okay, this is where I could never enter one of these contests, but you could send in your sweater. But you had to also send in all of the tags from your skeins so that they knew that you'd actually knit it.
Right.
I instantly lose all of those.
Well, and also just send in the thing that you're not, I feel like if you lose, do they send it back?
I know, and there were over 3,000. That's what I wondered too.
Yeah.
And you also have the return of in 1935 on the Boston Commons, you have this giant knitting marathon contest to knit a giant American flag. Nobody seems to know what happened to the flag, but there's a great story of men knitting
Right.
and one 67-year-old man who's, we have this great picture of him drawing his ball of yarn from his straw hat. And he told the reporter he was fine with talking and knitting at the same time because he said, quote, "You can't rattle me, young man. I'm an old hand at this. I'm just binding off my first square. I've been knitting since I was 16, although there have been many years when I've not knit at all. I knitted through the World War for soldiers, and since then I've knitted articles for disabled veterans. Yes, I have a wife, but I knew how to knit before I met her. And the title of the article was, quote, "Man can knit as good as woman."
Yes, and you also had the soap company Lux comes out, you know, on the bandwagon with, okay, you've put all this time into your hand knit items. You don't want to wash them the wrong way because then you're gonna ruin them. And so having this special soap, which is true.
Yeah, and I thought that was interesting how they emphasized not only the thrift behind knitting your own clothes, but also the importance of them being of a quality that could withstand the washing. This is also when the Wellesley girls, they're still knitting their little sweater sets at this point, but they're also knitting sweaters and socks for their boyfriends, and they start gifting them not only the socks, but the laundry services for washing the socks so that they won't end up with tiny felted Argyle Christmas ornaments.
Yes, this was a very interesting article. And some of the pictures reminded me of Grandma, our mom's mom, who in the 30s, and we'll see if we can find a picture. I don't think we have any pictures of her wearing hand knits. She sewed. She wasn't much of a knitter, but we do have a picture of her in a similar era of the long skirt.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised given the paucity of resources that lengths went back down again. But
Right.
so I guess we need to say, Booty, what are you knitting these days?
Well, trumpet sound.
Ba, 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 ba.
I have a finished object, which I love.
Oh.
I don't think I shared this before, but I am ready for Rhinebeck. Rhinebeck ready. I have my halibut sweater.
Oh my gosh.
I have a feeling that the weather is going to be way too hot for this. Maybe we can find an air conditioned, I don't know, someplace to. But it's fabulous. I love it so much. It really was pretty fast. It's the halibut sweater by Caitlin Hunter, and it's DK.
Oh, I love it. It's beautiful. And is it sort of a, I mean, once again, the sort of zoom quality on the camera, is it a reddish
Yes,
sort of
it's my usual
wine color? Okay.
wine color, and the main color is So Happy Jane Sustain, so it's a non superwash. I can see that my sleeves are a bit long, but oh well, I'm just gonna roll them up.
That's what girls did in the 30s, apparently. They rolled their sleeves up over their elbows.
Right, and
Yeah.
then the fish is making tracks in Valley Fog, I think. So it's really pretty, kind of light gray, but it's got little tinges of pink and tinges of like a light green. I gotta say, shout out to Heather at the Knitter Studio, who guided me toward that when I showed her what my main color was, and she suggested this one, and it's just perfect because there's a lot of
Yeah.
contrast, but it's working with a little bit of pink in there and the purpley,
It's great. I can't wait to see it in person.
and steal
Steal it. Yeah. Steal it.
it.
Well, it reminds me of the color, just the color combination is so great for the gold wing.
She guided me for that too.
Oh.
If
Yeah.
you are in the Bellevue, Seattle area, she's fabulous. It's
Yeah.
so good.
Because it is hard to figure out kind of complementary colors, and you want to have something that has interest, but it's not, especially with a pattern like that, it's got interest, but you don't want that to overshadow the pattern of the fish. You want the fish pattern to kind of stand out.
Exactly. I did a little bit of ladderback jacquard on there, which I think is a good thing to have in your pocket for color work. It's a
Yeah.
way to change colors without it sort of showing through and not
No,
catching your floats.
I need to learn how to do that. Well, I am finished with my giant white doily glimmer project for my friend
Yay.
Karen. I'll take a picture of that. I still have to sew up the seam. I liked how that came out. And I decided to start some color work. I'm going to do the Schneeflocken pattern, a two-color yoke sweater by Sarah Solomon, which I actually bought the pattern at the last Rhinebeck. They had a sample up and I really liked it. And this is just completely the wrong sweater for me to start color work with. For one thing, it's bottom up. So none of that nice checking the sizing of it that you told me is really a good thing. Not doing that. And then the other thing was I went to Webb's, America's Yarn Store, and picked out the yarn that I liked. It's really not the size that this pattern called for.
But and who knows anyway, because you lost the tag for it.
And I lost the tag for it. Yeah. It's moments like this where I look at my own behaviors and think, how can I possibly guide others? Apparently, it's just the dangling of cake in front of them that succeeds the most. Yeah, so it's completely the yarn is way bigger that I would never be able to get gauge. So
Well, and
I,
even if you did, it would be like armor.
yeah, so I thought that I could adjust the pattern, and that's probably just a huge mistake.
Well, you were talking about going up a size, so or several sizes of I'm not talking about needle sizes, but sizes of the sweater. So that kind of made sense to me. But the one thing I think that will be interesting to see how it pans out is when you get to the yoke, because it's not just about stitch count, but also row count. And when you have a yoke sweater that where you're doing the design, it does have like one depth
Yeah.
to it. So if you have a thicker yarn, it can be kind of hard to get that to work, but we'll see.
I can't believe you're not more supportive of this great experiment. And my plan is to start it and get it just far enough along that when you come out for Rhinebeck, I can hand it over to you and you'll finish it and fix it for me.
Oh,
That
that's a great
my
plan.
plan. Yeah.
Yeah, love that.
But
That's great.
yeah, well, this will be an interesting experiment. But well,
Mm-hmm.
Booty, I think we've covered some important ground here. We've covered the Oreo cake, Jevons Victory cake, and the history of Oreos, and knitting in the Depression, which will now be known as the Knitting Renaissance period, and then some good knitting projects. So I think it's time to say, whatever you do, don't
Don't knit
knit like
like
my
my
sister.
sister.
But do check out our website. And if you haven't subscribed yet, shame on you. You missed the opportunity for the Skelly kit, but we'd still love to have you subscribe. And you can do that on our website, bootyandbossy.com. And thanks again for listening.